stunned silence.
What is this? A bit of an episode.
So I must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its game, it's excellent.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Brilliant. You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 113 for February 15, 2017. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. It's like, 13, 15, 17.
There's lots of numbers, eh? This is that Fibonacci.
It's all sequential.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say they're prime numbers, and then I realised, no, divides into three or five.
Welcome to the 15th Station Maths podcast. And yes. And the one, the only, the original, the Don. How are you, Don?
Good, bro.
Good to talk to you both. And now, Gavin, we've been quite concerned. All the news over here in New Zealand has been talking about how in Australia, particularly in Sydney, where you are, it's been a bit warm, mate. A little bit warm.
Oh, it's been toasty, it's fair to say. So I was actually in Canberra, my old stomping ground, on the weekend. And it was 40 down there, so it's at 103 or something.
Right.
Something like 104, 105. But yeah, other places were a bit warmer than that, so up in the sort of probably 110, 115 sort of stuff.
Well,
so a lot of records broken for a country that's often hot in the summer for records to be broken.
That's saying something.
It's, I heard pretty bad.
One thing on the news here saying that it was either Saturday or Sunday, Sydney was officially the hottest place on earth. And I'm like, that feels wrong. There must be warmer places, but I guess, given with the way the seasons move, maybe not.
Well, yeah, somewhere in Australia would have been anyway. I don't know whether it would have been Sydney per se, but yeah. I'd somewhere like Toowoomba. Well-known place, Toowoomba.
Yes, of course, Toowoomba.
I think it might have been the hottest place. I saw something on the news today, but I think probably safe to say that somewhere in Australia was the hottest place in the world on Saturday and or Sunday. It's been hot, that's for sure.
It's been hot.
I'm ready for it to cool down.
That's what summer does, though. But how's your summer going there, Don? All well there, mate? You're sitting there nice in your house with the air conditioning on, have you?
Yeah, no, my air conditioning's broken, so...
Oh,
yeah.
What?
Oh, no.
Yeah, well it's going to be cool tomorrow, is it? It's like they always seem to show up the day the temperature drops.
That's actually, I think, in their service contract. Yeah, but there'll be some people that will be enjoying the heat, I'm sure, out there at the beach, and then there'll be others that'll be plenty concerned about it. So both praise and concern for your weather. And this ties in very poorly to our first article from Crux. In his first few days in office, President Donald Trump's flurry of executive orders drew both praise and concern from the nation's Catholic bishops, who commended a measure restricting international abortion funding, but criticized two orders aimed at tightening the flow of illegal immigration into the United States. On January 23rd, 3 days after being sworn in as president and in his first weekday of work in the White House, Trump signed an executive order restoring the Mexico City policy, revoking one of the first actions that former President Barack Obama had made in office on that same date 8 years earlier. The directive that prevents U.S. international health aid from funding abortion services had been signed by then-President George W. Bush in 2001 and in turn revoked by Obama and then restored again by Trump. The policy was first enacted in 1984 during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, a Republican, and in the years since has either been restored by successive Republican presidents or revoked by Democratic presidents. That's useful.
Executive orders are weird.
They're weird. In his executive action, Trump directed the Secretary of State, quote, to ensure that U.S. taxpayer dollars do not fund organizations or programs that support or participate in the management of a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization. That action by Trump was praised by New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan, chairman of the Committee on Pro-Life Activities of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who said in a statement that day, quote, we applaud President Trump's action today to restore the Mexico City policy, which withholds taxpayer funds from foreign non-governmental organizations that promote or perform abortions overseas, often in violation of the host country's own laws, end quote. New York's Cardinal Archbishop, who read a passage from the Book of Wisdom during Trump's inauguration ceremony, also said of the restoration of the Mexico City policy, this is a welcome step towards restoring and enforcing important federal policies that respect the most fundamental human right, the right to life, as well as the long-standing bipartisan consensus against forcing Americans to participate in the violent act of abortion. But 2 days later, Trump signed a pair of executive orders on immigration. One order directed that a wall be built along the U.S. border with Mexico to restrict illegal immigration, which he had promised repeatedly during his campaign rallies. Calling illegal immigration a clear and present danger to the United States, Trump, in the January 25th executive order, said its purpose is, quote, to direct executive departments and agencies to deploy all lawful means to secure the nation's southern border, to prevent further illegal immigration into the United States, and to repatriate illegal aliens swiftly, consistently, and humanely, end quote. Trump said that the new immigration policy would secure the southern border of the United States through the immediate construction of a physical wall on the southern border, monitored and supported by adequate personnel so as to prevent illegal immigration, drug and human trafficking, and acts of terrorism. In response, Bishop Joe Vasquez of Austin, Texas, the chair of the USCCB's Committee of Migration, and Bishop of the Diocese of Austin, Texas, said, I am disheartened that the president has prioritized building a wall on our border with Mexico. This action will put immigrant lives needlessly in harm's way. Construction of such a wall will only make migrants, especially vulnerable women and children, more susceptible to traffickers and smugglers. The USCCB statement opposing the presidential that the approximately 2,000-mile-long U.S.-Mexico border already has 700 miles of fencing and barriers. Vasquez said that the... I don't know, I think it's pronounced his name, is it?
Probably.
It would be on par with my normal efforts. Vasquez said that building such a wall destabilizes the many vibrant and beautifully interconnected communities that live peacefully along the border. Instead of building walls at this time, my brother bishops and I continue to follow the example of Pope Francis. We will look to build bridges between people, bridges that allow us to break down the walls of exclusion and exploitation, he said. Probably one of the longest first stories we've had, Mr. Editor, but I
think... Well, and the thing is, we didn't even really get to the last one, which is the other executive order.
No.
Which is, stopping the immigration from the seven countries that are on the hit list. The bishop didn't like that one either. It was really hard to edit.
Yeah. So let's recap in summary for those who kind of tuned out a little bit. We've got Donald Trump coming in as president in his first week going, I'm going to sign some executive orders because that's what presidents do. First, I'm going to continue the tennis court volley, rally, whatever you call it, where I just bring back in the thing that the previous guy repealed ahead of the next Democratic president who will then repeal it again. But at least for the next 4 years, this will be in play. And the thing I find...
Eight years. Just joking.
Don't laugh so hard. The thing I'm interested to explore on this one, before we get on to the immigration policies, is particularly that phrasing in the quote there, Gavin. This is to ensure that US taxpayer dollars do not fund organizations or programs that support or participate in the management of a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization. Now, if you are in the so-called pro-choice area, tell me how you could possibly support a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization, by the very definition, removing any choice from the equation. Surely, this must be something which Republicans and Democrats can see is actually a good thing. That part of it, at least, anyway.
Well, so one might be able to argue that this might or might not be the most... a political statement or executive order in the history of the presidency.
might be able to argue that, you think?
One might. One would hope that anyone would think, well, if you're in favor of choice, therefore you wouldn't be in favor of people being forced to have abortions. But, what does the word forced mean? There'd be a lot of places around the world where women are, if not, truly forced, then certainly encouraged very strongly to do certain things. And I guess, in some ways we often hear about how certain Christian agencies do things in a way that's sort of like, oh, we're going to support you in a certain way, but we're also going to give you a bit of the old evangelism at the same time. Whether there might be other agencies on the other side who might say, oh, we're going to help you out with some aspect of a life that's challenging for you for a reason, but the only way we're going to do that is if, we can help support population control in your country because we can't have too many people on the earth because that's bad for the planet.
But see, even that, I mean, maybe I'm just oversimplifying and I'm just totally naive here, Don, but surely, I mean, okay, I'm trying to play a devil's advocate, and that is a very, very appropriately selected term, I have to say. But if you are the biggest pro-choice person on the planet and you're like, you know what, American taxpayer dollars should be spent funding international abortion programs and right to sexual reproduction of health and all that kind of stuff, yeah? Still, surely, that particular phrase, like, I thought what he was going to say was that support or participate in the management of a program of abortion or sterilization. But coercive or involuntary, that sounds like, that sounds terrible. It sounds torturous. Surely no one could support that.
There will be a subset of those pro-choice people who believe in, as Gavin was alluding to, population control and basically resource management. And they'll have an ideology where people are basically resource-hungry and need to be controlled in terms of size.
Really? Do we think that's more than like a couple of absolute, what's the technical term, nut jobs? Like, Gavin,
I think that's the technical term.
Is that the technical term? I'm pretty sure it is, right? Like, I can totally, if you subscribe to the relatively warped ideology that says abortion is about, you know, women's choice and all the normal stuff that you hear from the pro-choice thing, and, you know, it's about their sexual reproductive freedom and all this, I can get why you would say, and hence subsequent presidents knocking it back and forward. I can get how this is a political line that's drawn. Traditionally, pro-choice, pro-abortion people are on the Democratic side of the line of the last few decades anyway, and pro-life are on the Republican. So I get that. But I'm just struggling to see what right-minding, what right-thinking, logical, you know, person's going to sit there and go, I think the US taxpayer should fund involuntary sterilization programs and coercive abortion.
They believe there'll be a subset of those pro-choice people, and it'll be a smaller subset, but they believe that people are pollutants.
Amazing.
So if you believe that people are pollutants, then killing them is a good thing.
Amazing. And that is, and at the same time, you're just grateful that your parents weren't, you know, involuntarily sterilized in order to be able to give you birth to you so that you could live that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we're probably veering off the topic a little bit, like in terms of, you know, should, even if we, you know, those words coercive and involuntary, I still think there's a case to be made for whether taxpayer dollars should be used to fund abortions or sterilizations of any kind overseas, which is,
Especially American taxpayer dollars, because if you look at the stats, America is pretty much the brokest country on the planet. this is true. Okay, they've got a high GDP per capita, but they, in terms of their debt as a proportion of total GDP, they're pretty close to 100%. So, like, everything they make in an entire year, they owe in terms of debt. So, really, if other countries want to pay their, you know, want to kill their young, they should really be doing that on their own dime.
They should not on the borrowed dollar of the Americans. Okay, so I think that policy is pretty, I mean, with the exception, the only reason why I was focusing on the coercive and involuntary is I sort of thought, really, really, you'd have to be really insane to think that that's a good idea. But in terms of a Republican president signing into legislation or the executive order that they're going to stop funding abortion, that's you know, and apparently it was a Tuesday. I mean, you know, that's not that surprising. What was a little bit more surprising was that President Trump decided to follow through, Gavin, with some of his, I don't know, policies? Rantings? Ravings? I don't know. What do you call it when you say you're going to build a wall?
Stream of consciousness.
Stream of consciousness. And there were a number of people, some of whom are friends of this podcast, who have pointed out to me Trump was, how do you phrase it? He wasn't being literal. He wasn't being serious. He was being, you know.
Figurative,
yeah. No, but on the campaign trail, he was, you know, he'll come right as president. And in his first week, they build that wall, and I'm going to find a way for the Mexicans to pay for it. Really? What did you make of his wall-building immigration policy across the Mexican border, Gavin?
I guess it is kind of a crazy thing to hear somebody, a politician, and if we can call him that, or someone who takes the office of president, we can certainly call him that, actually doing what they say, particularly, I don't know if you were alluding to me there, James, who you said, people on the show were like, well, I may well have said it. I think I've said to some people, surely he can't be, surely he can't do all the things he said he was going to do. And
No, it wasn't you.
Lo and behold.
I definitely had like some friends on Facebook and others saying, you know, the problem is that the people who voted
for Trump are taking him literally.
Yeah, the people who voted for Trump didn't take him literally, they took him seriously. And the people who didn't vote for him took him literally. I think that was the distinction. And here he is being both serious and literal about something which, you know, I'm as shocked as you about a politician sticking to a promise he made on the campaign trail. Let's start with that.
I think the wall. We've discussed the wall before. I don't know whether maybe we should spend a bit more time talking about the other thing around the
let's get on to the seven countries. Yep.
I'm keen on the groundswell.
Yep. Let's talk about that one. But just before we do, Don, any thoughts on the wall?
I don't think the Vatican's in any place to make any comment on this because they're the most walled city on the planet. there's a wall around Vatican City.
Yeah, so, but it's not to keep Mexicans out, is it?
No, to keep Italians out.
Yeah.
It's generally to keep people out. There's not a lot of refugees that go in there. But my second point would be that there's about 350,000 refugees. It's not refugees, but illegal immigrants that come through every year into the US. You've got about the same amount going out, but 350,000 is a lot of people to be coming illegally into some country. So if you take just that number, maybe the wall might work, maybe it won't. Also, in terms of drugs, like no one's really mentioned the drug issue to a large extent, but 90% of the drugs that come into the US, and if you look at some cities, it's a major problem in a lot of US cities. People are calling it an epidemic, but 90% of the drugs that come into the US come through mules. So these mules are presumably coming through the kind of illegal immigration routes.
But hang on, Don. So you got a few things there, right? So I've never heard the parallel with the Vatican City before. I love that. That's brilliant. I think the point around building a wall to keep, you know, you're right, in terms of protecting borders and everything else, even though the US was founded on the bring me your tired, huddled masses yearning to be free philosophy, that has obviously changed a little bit more.
Yeah, but no country on the planet has an unlimited open borders immigration policy.
Yeah, I understand that. Usually, there's very few, and I think about Europe, you know, there's very few that build a wall, you know, especially of the magnitude and proportions that President Trump was describing on the campaign trail. There's already 700 miles worth of fencing and barriers. I guess rounding that out to make it 2,000, lots of fencing and barriers, would be different from building a wall. I mean, the guy was describing building like a 20-foot concrete barrier 2,000 miles long. I mean,
Someone else said, show me a 20-foot wall and I'll show you a 21-foot ladder.
And that was my point on the drugs thing. Like, seriously? Oh, well, I mean, we're kind of off the Catholic topic here, so maybe we can move on to the immigration one. But I just don't see how building a wall is going to stop drugs getting into the country.
I don't know how the illegal immigrants are coming through to the country right now, so I don't know how effective a wall would be. It wouldn't be my priority if I was president, but then I'm not privy to a lot of the information that presumably the Trump administration is privy to.
That's
maybe
true.
They're privy to some information around, you know, terrorists using that route to infiltrate the US.
So
Who knows? Let's
talk about terrorists and the information that President Trump would have got in those very, very impactful 72 hours. He then also signs off on these seven countries, Gavin, and says, here's this watch list, which I'll start straight away by saying the Republicans didn't come up with. It was a watch list that was created by the Democrats, right? But what's been counted, as I've seen all through social media, is that none of the attacks that have occurred on US soil have had nationals from these countries. In fact, the countries that have had nationals continue to be unhindered. And the president has struggled to get this order actually enforced because the courts have ruled it illegal. But to say anyone from these seven countries, even if you've got a legal green card and you're allowed in the States, well, no, you're not. And it's all about securing our borders and I'm shutting them down. Bit of a big statement, bit of a big call, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's always a bit, you know, makes me a bit nervous. It happened in Australia when there was an attempt to address illegal immigration. And once the courts start saying, yeah, what you're doing is not legal or not constitutional or whatever the different mechanisms might be in different countries, that makes me a little bit nervous about the policies of someone. And I think I think there might have been a sense that he would do something like this. I mean, he did foreshadow something like this. But I think the thing that shocked people the most, there are many things that have shocked people about it, and rightly so, I think. But, you know, that idea that, oh, if you're from there, and even if you're already, you know, hanging out here, yeah, maybe you can't get back in the country when you leave and try to come back. So which we've seen all of these, you know, massive multinational companies say, you know, basically I can't operate without this workforce, all of these wonderful people from different countries that are on the list. You're trying to take away my workforce. So it's been a massive swelling and a lot of, you know, grassroots efforts as well to, you know, people who, reunions with families are now off and all these sorts of things. You know, in some ways the business side of things is a lesser concern than some of the other relational and familial consequences of this. It's it's pretty I think it's pretty concerning. As you say, it sort of was sort of put in place under Obama, but not really enacted. So it's, I find it pretty hard to stomach.
Yeah, bit tricky. Don, what did you make of this policy?
Oh, it's a terrible policy, badly enacted. But it's not a Muslim ban, so it's not as bad as the left is making it out to be. And it's not a Muslim ban because 85% of the world's Muslims are not even remotely affected by this ban. And the seven countries on that list are countries that have been identified by the previous administration as having a substantial terrorist risk. So in terms of the selection of the countries, you can blame the previous administration. But in terms of how it was enacted and how it was thought through and exactly how the policy was going to be implemented and just the vagaries around it,
amateur.
It's kind of like B for effort and C for implementation.
C is a generous mark.
It's a fail, mate. It was like I don't think there is any way like you could look at that and say even if he took the list from the Democrats and said from Obama, and I don't understand the list itself in the sense of I thought Obama's administration, sorry, not Obama himself sitting down writing down seven countries. The administration identified them in terms of serious terrorism risk at the time. They didn't propose banning all immigration from those countries, though. And then
No, right.
So to take it to the extreme where you go, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to shut the airports, and we're going to do it with no forewarning, nothing for the embassies or anything else. That's it. Close the borders. And even if you are from that country, legitimately allowed to travel into the States and gone through whatever checks you need to for a green card, which is not exactly easy, to just holus bolus, close down, you're not allowed to go it. Is beyond amateur hour. I mean, I was astonished to watch it happen. I was sitting there going, does he just want to be compared to Hitler, or does he get out of bed and he goes, what's something I can do today that is just a stupid thing to do? So even if you had people who have you know a lot of Americans voted for him, a lot of Americans voted for not Hillary, and you're now trying to get the whole of the U.S. united, this is not the way to do it. Doing policies like this, which separate families, is not the way to do it. And I take your point around not being a Muslim ban, but at the same time, the seven countries are all predominantly Muslim. All seven of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just...
But, yes. But there aren't a lot of Christian countries around carrying out major terrorist activities, unfortunately.
Well, it depends on your definition of terrorism, I would say. But
depends on your definition of fortune.
Yeah.
As well, I guess.
I think my general summary, I don't know if I'm going to give him a grade, but I'd say in his first couple of weeks in office, El Presidente Trump has maybe got the reverse problem of what Pope Francis had in his first same amount of time in his post. There is no honeymoon effect. You've got the entire media who are already going to be baying for his blood no matter what he did, who are now sitting there going, oh, this is magic. We don't even need to make this stuff up. Because any time they sit there and go, gee, what can we report about Trump today? What's something we could say today that is just crazy? He goes and tweets it, and they just basically replace it. But I'm jumping ahead of stories. Let's come back a little bit closer to home. This is from News Hub. Our so-called God's own country is fast becoming anything but. A century ago, New Zealand was one of the most religious places on earth. Was it? Look at that.
Well, the story says so. With the great majority of... news, is it?
No, no. Alternative facts. With the great majority of Kiwis, Pākehā, Māori alike believing in some form of Christianity. Fast forward a few generations, and not only Christianity, but belief in any form of religion has dissipated to the point where almost half of all Kiwis don't associate with any religious belief at all. Comparing the decline in religious belief over the past five national censuses shows just how accelerated non-belief has become since the 1990s. Massey University President Peter Lynham has studied religious history in New Zealand for decades and says today's society does not value religious commitment as our free time and financial circumstances have changed. Historically, religion flourished among what we would call middle-income people, the middle classes. Now, today, that's the area of tremendous decline in religiosity, he said. New Zealand's biggest city is by far the country's most religious, but the topography of where the religion is based has changed markedly. Quote, in the old days, Remuera and the North Shore were the areas of strong religious groups represent. Professor Lynham said he didn't say represent, but he should have. Today, they're significantly weaker. That's because in South Auckland and West Auckland, you have these very large Pentecostal megachurches frequented by Pacifica peoples, and the large Catholic churches are still flourishing. Most migrants to New Zealand...
Could have fooled me.
Could bring with them some kind of religious belief, but they arrive in a country that has very little. Professor Lynham says that Pacific Island peoples, Chinese, Koreans, and Filipinos, are now the dominant people in New Zealand's traditional churches. Quote, that's a very big change. New Zealand is very irreligious compared to most other societies. Koreans come here to live and are alarmed by our secular society. End quote. New Zealand still has a high level of religious belief among teenagers, but Professor Lynham says this falls dramatically as Kiwis get older. Well, we'll come back to that. Don, what do you make of Professor Lynham's study? We've talked about some of his research in the past, and I mean, this probably isn't news so much as confirmation of something we already know.
Correct. And my questions would be around, we've got 60,000 people or 60,000 students in Catholic schools. Why is this happening and why aren't we churning out more people who remain religious of those 60,000?
Yeah, I mean, when that last comment there around higher level of religious belief among teenagers, it falls dramatically as Kiwis get older. I mean, one would argue that that's after they leave school. And how much is the schools, you would hope the Catholic schools are giving people a great start, and or I would say a reaffirmation and a deepening of their faith. That's what you would hope for. Faith begins in the home, as we know. But as you become older and that sort of drop off, you'd want to see an improvement on that, you would think, Gavin.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon to look at because often we think about how, and he says it drops off when dramatically as they get older. I wonder if there's another spike towards the end of their lives, because often we think about churches having quite a few older people in them. So I don't know whether that's just a hangover and, sort of our generation when we get to our 60s and 70s, there will still be none. Very few of our friends will be in church, whereas now we see lots of older people in churches and fewer younger people. So I found it interesting that that New Zealand has a high level of religious belief among teenagers. I wouldn't have necessarily predicted that. That's why Professor Lynham looks after looking at religious trends, and I don't. Obviously there's a role for the family and a role for schools, for those who choose a religious school, Catholic or otherwise, for their children's education. But I think, sometimes we can place a bit too much emphasis on where the school fits and where the family fits. And indeed, we're a parish, the life of a parish, and what a parish or a diocese does to try and engage and keep engaged younger people when they do move into universities and work and those sorts of things. I suspect there'd be a similar phenomenon realized in other parts of life as well. Sort of those commitment or belonging organizations would see similar drifts when children move away from home and some of the routines of their teenage years fall away. It's probably not just religion that falls into this category.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and I guess we'll continue to talk about it. It is, on the positive side, it's good to see a fresh influx coming from those who move to this country and bring their religion with them and sort of show us Kiwis how it should be done. But at the same time, it does seem to be a continuing trend away in our country. And while there is some growth, you know, you'd like to see it happening across the board, not just from immigration.
If you look at the stats in the States, it's only the Orthodox and traditionalist type communities that are growing. So I think there's a lesson there to basically increase the level of Orthodoxy and catechesis among all three of the parishes, the schools, and from parents.
It's a good point. It's got to be. It takes a village, isn't it? The phrase.
And they talk about there are a lot of ways in which often the sort of the three-legged stool metaphor is used, and possibly this is another area where school, for those who choose a religious education or an education in religious school, that schools, parish, and family need to sort of be all pulling in the same direction.
Yep, here, here. This next article doesn't really need a segue. And understand, Gavin, you may need to opt out of some of the discussion given your work. But this is from ABC Australia. The Australian Catholic Church has released grim data revealing 7% of priests working between 1950 and 2009 have been accused of child sex crimes. The worst offending institutions by proportion of their religious staff have been shown to be the Orders of Brothers, who often run schools and homes for the most vulnerable of children. This is the most substantial data set released to date about the extent of child sex abuse within the Australian Catholic Church, and was done with cooperation from them as part of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. The Church surveyed 10 religious institutes and 75 church authorities to uncover the abuse data on priests, non-ordained brothers and sisters, and other church personnel who were employed between 1950 and 2009. Council Gail Furness, SC, said 4,444 alleged child sex abuse incidents were recorded in the survey. 90% of the victims were boys, with their average age at time of abuse being 11.5 years old. Girls were only 10.5 years old on average when they were abused. 7% of priests ministering in the 60-year period have been accused of child sex offences. This is an even starker figure to similar research carried out in the US, which found that from 1950 through June 2015, 5.6% of the 116,153 priests who worked have been accused of child sexual abuse. So the Royal Commission is coming to a bit of an end, as I understand it, Gavin. You can probably comment at least on this bit. So the Royal Commission is coming to an end and the findings are kind of being released at this point. Along with, I guess, recommendations and things like that? Is that how a Royal Commission usually works?
Yeah, so the Royal Commission started its hearings in 2013, and a number of, I think there have been, they're called case studies, so I think this is case study number 50. So, and they've often looked at a diocese or a school system or a particular religious organisation throughout those 49, and case study 50, which is a three-week one which we're sort of in the middle of at the moment, is what's being called the Catholic Wrap-Up, where a series of people are being called from the church, including bishops and other church leaders, including people who've worked with religious orders and in seminaries and those sorts of places, as they try to ascertain some of the facts around child sexual abuse as it relates to the Catholic Church, and also ask some questions about possible causes, possible solutions, and then there are a series of other similar case studies that are going to be heard over the next few months as the Royal Commission sort of winds down its work. And then later in the year, I think it's expected towards the end of the year, there will be a series of recommendations issued some of which will be general, some of which may relate particularly to issues around the Catholic Church. So, yeah, it's been a particularly trying, you know, that those numbers have been particularly, you know, grim, confronting, horrifying, any number of adjectives for people reading them around the world, and but as you'd expect, people here in Australia hearing them. It's been a very difficult time, but an important time too for the church to re-examine what's happened and to redouble efforts that have been significant in the last 15 to 20 years to put protocols and procedures in place to make sure the church is as safe as could possibly be.
I think, I mean, Don, it's a difficult topic every time we talk about it, and unfortunately we have to talk about it quite a bit on this podcast and have done over the years. But these numbers do make for some pretty stark reading. I mean, 7%, you know, you're getting close to 1 in 10 at that point. What did you make of the story when you heard about it?
It's shocking. Well, 1 in 10 is a lot higher than I would have expected, which I did a little bit of research, but probably not enough research, but I've probably got more questions than answers.
The thing that I found really shocking was just the number. You know, when you start hearing 7%, which is obviously the natural reaction I think a lot of people are going to have, that is a very high proportion of accusations. It's fair to point out, you know, and accusations, some of which, just by the, as shown through the other international disasters, that's probably the best word for them, may prove not to be accurate, but that doesn't, you know, there's enough in there that will be. There's enough that will have been genuine, that there will be genuine abuse, for this to be a staggeringly disgusting number. Now, the one thing that I find interesting, or if I was trying to find a, I don't know if I'd even call it a glimmer of hope, but I did see some research that was seen around that was looking at the proportion of priests whose first allegation of abuse fell within a given decade. And when you look at those, this is basically looking over that period of time they're talking about, 1950 through 2009. It is absolutely in the 1950s, the 1960s. You're seeing these rates, which are just, you know, astonishing. You know, Archdiocese of Brisbane, 2.2% in the 1950s, 3.3% in the 1960s, 2.5% in the 1970s. By the time you get into the 1980s and 1990s, you're starting to see the numbers drop off, 1.2%, 0.6% in the 1990s, and then 0% in the 2000s. And that seems to be a trend across all the archdioceses and dioceses in Australia that are in this study, which, you know, if you're trying to find, I wouldn't even call it a silver lining, but, I mean, at least you're starting to see that some of those, as you highlighted, Gavin, you know, protocols and changes and conditions that have been put into place over the last few years seem to be taking effect. I do point out that there are still accusations that have been lodged in the 2000s, although none of them, I think the 1% or 1.3% for the Archdiocese of Canberra. But other than that, most are 0%ers. There should be 0% full stop. There should be no accusations, false or accurate. There should be no accusations accused at the church. And that has to be our goal. It has to be at the point where there is no abuse, sexual or physical, coming from members of the cloth, or brothers or sisters or anyone associated with the church. Quite frankly, the number needs to be zero across the world. But with inside the church as a whole, it has to be held to a higher standard. So I look at this Royal Commission and I say, I'm hoping what it is an expunging of demons and a righting of wrong. Well, you can never right these kind of wrongs, but as much as possible. And then really making sure, you know, as I was saying to I was talking to my kids the other day, not about this, thankfully, but I was talking to them about why do they think it's important to learn about history. And my seven-year-old, she said, so that you don't make the same mistakes again. And I thought that was very, very, that was bang on, and we need to be looking at this and never forgetting this is the situation that we found ourselves in as a church, and never, ever, ever tolerating, allowing, moving, shifting, fooling ourselves and kidding ourselves into or any of the other stuff that caused the problem over the last 50 years, so that our children, at least, never, ever, ever have to suffer what is just abhorrent, diabolical behaviour.
Yeah, the just one caveat on the numbers, and you've obviously quoted that information correctly, James, around the tapering off of numbers in terms of accusations. There is a stat that suggests that the average period of time that it takes for someone to report abuse might is something I think like 30 years.
Right.
So it's possible that it's latent and that will revert. I am incredibly hopeful that that's not the case and there truly has been a lessening. I mean, let's be honest, society has changed significantly in the last 40 or 50 years. The church needed to change drastically given what was happening, but all of society has changed in a way that makes it so much harder for, one, the crimes to happen, but two, the cover-up that allowed it to continue to manifest itself. I won't say it's impossible to happen again, but it's very difficult for the same sort of culture to exist. Thanks be to God for that. Yeah. But there was a woman who gave evidence from Ireland, where obviously this has been a huge scourge as well, who said they've got a really strong system in place, and it's been in place for 7 or 8 years or something. And she said now the great enemy is complacency.
Yeah.
Put systems in place, and how do you ensure that they don't become loosened or just that even a glimmer of hope for people who are evil to their core, that they can come back and infiltrate the system again. That needs to be, vigilance needs to be strong.
Eternal vigilance, yeah. Eternal vigilance is the price that we pay for this, and generational, I mean, it will always be a component of our church and the history of our church. And I agree with you on the societal shift, and I also take some hope that we have address the root cause of the issue, but I just staggering numbers so close to home, and you just wonder what it would be like in New Zealand as well. Well, we'll move on. Totally unrelated, but let's just move on. This is from America magazine. America. Pope Francis has ordered a review of Liturgium Authenticum, a controversial decree behind the most recent translations of liturgical texts from Latin into English and other languages. The commission, established by the Pope just before Christmas, is also tasked with examining what level of decentralization is desirable in the Church on matters such as this. Francis has had two main reasons for setting up the commission, according to informed sources. First, in line with the Second Vatican Council, he wants to give greater responsibility and authority to bishops' conferences. He stated this clearly in his programmatic document, Evangelii Gaudium, where he wrote, "The Second Vatican Council stated that, like the ancient patriarchal churches, episcopal conferences are in a position to contribute in many and fruitful ways to the concrete realization of the collegial spirit. Yet this desire has not been fully realized, since the juridical status of episcopal conferences, which would see them as subjects of specific attributions, including genuine doctrinal authority, has not yet been sufficiently elaborated. Excessive centralization, rather than proving helpful, complicates the Church's life and her missionary outreach." That's a easy-to-read passage.
Rolls off the tongue.
Number 32. Done. In this context, the question that arises in terms of liturgy is to clarify what is the role of the Bishop of Rome in preserving unity in the Church, given that liturgy, the Roman Rite, creates unity in the Latin Church. The Commission will address this issue. Second, some bishops' conferences are unhappy with the translation of the Roman Missal required by Liturgium Authenticum. They consider it too rigid and do not accept that there's such a thing as sacral language. They charge that Liturgium seeks an almost literal translation of the Latin liturgical texts into the vernacular or local language of the different countries, often with unsatisfactory results. The Japanese, for example, had a long-running battle with the congregation over who should decide what is an acceptable Japanese translation of these texts. They and several other bishops' conferences are clearly unhappy with the directives of Liturgium and the level of centralization involved in it. The new commission set up by Pope Francis will review this whole matter, together with the issue of enculturation and the question of what decentralization is desirable in matters relating to the liturgy. It's all fun and games in the liturgical committees in Rome right now. What do you make of all this, Don? He's ordered a review of Liturgium Authenticum. That was top of your list of things you wanted him to review, right?
Absolutely.
What do you think? So this commission, according to informed sources, is going to be looking at the fact that the Second Vatican Council said more decentralization, apparently.
Right. What I see this is the Pope dipping his toes into the decentralization of the church and the Anglicanization of the church. Ooh. And, you know, it's liturgy today, it's morality tomorrow. It's already started with, you know, the footnote and the edict on divorced Catholics receiving communion. And I think he really sees a decentralization of the church much akin to the model of the Anglican Church. And we've seen how the Anglican Church ends up. And,
hang on. He's seen how the Anglican Church ends up. He's not going, you know what, that's a great model. I think we should repeat that. You don't honestly believe that. Come on, Don.
I do.
Come on. You think that the Pope Francis is looking to the Anglican Communion, so-called, and going, that's a better model than what we've got. Let's rock with that.
Well, that's what the Anglican model is, and that's where he's heading towards. So, I don't know.
Okay, Gavin, maybe, what do you reckon?
Not looking at him.
Do you reckon that Don's claim that Pope Francis is a closet Anglican is has foundations? Okay, so do you think this review is expected, surprising, a good thing, a bad thing, indifferent? Where's the Gavin on this?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. One of my concerns is, so most of our listeners are very learned people, but so basically, in the, you know, up till the 60s, we had everyone had mass in Latin, and then there was a move towards the vernacular. So whatever language is spoken in your country becomes the language in which the mass is celebrated, and then a process was established to try and translate the Latin text into English. And a certain process was used, and a lot of people thought that was pretty imprecise and didn't create a great outcome. So over about three decades, there were different discussions around this. And then about, 12 or 14 years ago, there was a new process started to translate it again, using a new translation model or principle. So of formal equivalence as opposed to dynamic equivalence, which had been the previous one. And we've ended up with some language that's, I think there are legitimate criticisms of some parts of the translation. But my concern is, okay, so we come up with a new plan, and then maybe we do a new translation. And do we have any expectation that we should think it's going to be better than the current one or the one before that?
It was so much fun the last time. I kind of get that the main complaint that seems to come from this is around things like consubstantial in the English translation. You know, that we now have consubstantial with the Father, and everyone goes, consubstantial? Oh, what a word.
Never
Who
heard
uses
of it.
That? I've never heard of it. Blah, blah, blah. And everyone loses their mind. And you're like, can we all just take a chill pill? Because for a moment, this context for me, the way I look at this is, I go, the previous translation, when I looked at it in comparison to the current translation, felt like a lot of the prayers and other things felt very sort of loose and flowing and, quite frankly, hippie-ish. Like, you know, I look through it and I felt dated. And then I've seen some of the literal translation, like, you know, when you read the Latin mass and then it has the English beside the Latin, I'm like, that feels a little bit convoluted, similar to, in fact, number 32 from Evangelii Gaudium, to be entirely frank. But I look at all this and I go, well, do you get the sense, though, Don, and I may be opening myself up for an uppercut here, but do you get the sense that Jesus might be sitting there going, oh, how much time and effort are they spending on this, when really all the words we use are imperfect, all the language we use is imperfect, the people are imperfect, but that's actually part of the appeal of the church? I don't know. Where does that fit in with your Francis as an Anglican theory?
No, I agree. There's bigger things that we need to be worrying about. But liturgy is very important. It's how we communicate with God. So it's not something that we shouldn't spend any time on. But there's certainly bigger things happening in the church and bigger fish to fry.
That's a good point. And to be fair to Don, he didn't put on the lineup, Kevin. But I
well, no, he didn't. But,
so I see.
Oh, I mean, it's a big story.
It is a big story. I think, you know, the thing is, I can see both sides of the debate here. But what I don't want to have is, a la our first story, have subsequent popes overturning and retranslating what the previous Pope said, because, you know, some of the stuff, as I think we've talked about on the podcast before, some of the stuff when I was kind of made aware of it, I was like, well, that's pretty critical. Like, for example, the for many or for all, you know, in the Eucharistic prayer, referring to this being a new covenant for all in the old translation, for many, pro multis from the Latin, being the current translation, and the inference being it's not everyone. You actually have to, you know, accept Christ into your life. You have to accept this mission. You can't just sort of be sitting there and living your own life. Now, that's quite a lot of controversy, because people are like, oh, no, it's for everyone, regardless, you know, and then others go, no, it's not. So I see how sides get developed. Yeah.
Well, I get the idea of, you know, in Scripture, there's a sense in which, is it the centurion who invites Jesus under his roof?
Lord, I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. But yeah. Only so the word.
Like, I get that Scripture, there are scriptural
I like that,
roots
though.
To that.
Yeah. I well, liked it.
Yeah,
I liked it.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm not, yeah. You know, that's fine. The translation is a, you know, somewhat subjective thing, right? And you like that, and I sort of thought, you know, receive was not too bad.
Yeah.
But I think you also need to put in the context that we're offering Mass, and we're basically, you know, the transubstantiation and the Eucharist is the summit of our faith, and the language that we use in the Mass should reflect that. And I don't think it did before, and I believe that the new translation is a closer reflection of the reverence that we ought to give the Mass and the Eucharist.
I'd agree with that.
And anything away from that is bad.
Okay, so I think that's a fair opinion and position, and I think a number of people hold it. I think a lot of the people who seem to be vocal about this maybe are lamenting the loss of something that they had got used to post the translation in the 60s. I kind of get the feeling that we sort of celebrated Mass one way for centuries, and then the last few decades we're trying to sort of stumble and find our way through the vernacular. There's some of these themes over the years, Gavin, that seem to emerge, and it feels like we'll be talking about them for a long time. I don't know how often, though, we've talked about what Jesus would tweet, though. Our last story from the
Not
Huffington
enough,
Post.
Probably. Not
Stephen
enough.
Colbert kicked off the year with a hilarious look at what Jesus Christ might sound like if he were around to tweet, like President Donald Trump did over the holidays. The late-night host returned to his show after a break for the holiday season and used the opportunity to see what Trump was up to over the last few weeks. Not surprisingly, the then-president-elect didn't hold back on Twitter over the holidays, and Colbert wasn't sparing any jokes on his show. In the holiday spirit, Colbert joked, Donald Trump is loving his enemies, as only Donald Trump can. His New Year tweet sums it up best, and I quote, Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly they just don't know what to do. Love! Exclamation mark. The holiday spirit can mean different things, but we're pretty sure it doesn't mean offering smug messages of false magnanimity. This is the Huffington Post editorial, obviously. To put things in perspective, Colbert imagined what Jesus would sound like if he used an equally self-congratulatory tone, and it went something like this. Suck it at Pontius Pilate. I rose from the dead. At the real Jesus is going to live forever. Love. This is
Exclamation mark.
Yeah. Nice light story, Gavin. But I mean, I do think, though, that any time I sit there and think to myself, what would I do if I was president? Tweeting is probably not top of the list. And
seriously,
one of the dangers, right, with Twitter, nothing to do with the president, but one of the dangers with Twitter is always the fact that people mistake it for thinking it's their personal diary and no one can actually see what you're writing. Everyone can see what you're writing. And sometimes, you know, when you write that email reply and you're like, oh, I'm going to tell Gavin, oh, I'll tell him what I really think. You always delete the person's name before you write it in case you accidentally send it. It's those kind of tips and tricks that is how you survive in corporate America, a place where Donald Trump has come from, and yet he tweets like this. Come on, Donald. Do you follow
Which Donald?
Trump. You wouldn't refer to the
Don
as
Donald.
Yeah. Do you follow him on Twitter there, Gavin?
I don't. But one needn't follow him on Twitter to know what he's saying because everybody reports it.
What's his latest tweet? As at this point. Just leaving Florida. Big crowds of enthusiastic supporters lining the road that the fake news media refuses to mention. Very dishonest. I mean, love it.
It's, oh, I mean, real.
Oh. You can't make this.
I think I might have talked about Professor Robert George on the show before. A very learned man from the US who I'm friends with on Facebook. He must have been having a very kind day that day when he accepted my friend request. But he talks about, you know, then this is no longer a light story. But how Trump had the potential to, and seems to be living up to that potential, to demean the office of president by his behavior. And I think that tweet alone offers a stark example of how he is managing to achieve that. It's just, yeah. So Stephen Colbert, again, is, you know, it's a bit weird when Stephen Colbert is trying to be the moral compass of America and the president is maybe not being that.
Not that person. What did you make of it, Don? Hey, do you think is that how Jesus would tweet if Jesus was a tweeter?
No, I don't think. I don't think he'd say "suck it."
See, that's
in a kind of weird way. I'd kind of maybe respect him a little bit more if he did say "suck it."
Yeah,
but
Jesus or Trump?
Both.
But Trump probably does say that.
Yes, Trump does say "suck it" a lot. And I don't think, you know, Jesus is into the whole sarcasm thing really either.
No.
I could be wrong though.
We have been for 113 episodes though.
Yeah.
Into the sarcasm thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I just get lost for words.
News is only 40. Oh no, there's only 47 months to go.
It's a lot of tweets, mate. That is a lot of tweets. If you would like to, I don't think we've talked about our tweets before, but if you'd like to tweet to us, you can. You can reach out to us at twitter.com/station15 or on facebook.com/station15.
We won't tell anyone to suck it.
No, we won't. We won't. We promise. We promise. If you want to listen to our previous episodes, check them out at station15.co.nz. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, searching for the 15th station. Or on the Google Play Store, or you can just from our website, in fact. And if you want to go old school, send us an email. We do love hearing from you, and thanks for those who have been sending them in recently as well. You can reach out to us at podcast@station15.co.nz. I think feedback also works if I've used that one in the past. Thanks very much, Don. Always good to talk to you, mate.
Likewise, bro.
Yeah, always good. And Gavin, glad that you could get us all together again.
I'm disappointed that Don has obviously offended all the girls who used to come, all the ladies who used to come on the show. So you might have to reach out and get some feminine genius on the show.
Yeah, we could try.
But thank you, James.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. Nice lead-in. and to everyone else out there, I hope you had a great St. Valentine's Day and that you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.